This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. And today's show, we planned based on some listener input. I bumped into at a social event, a regular listener named Maureen, and she asked, could you possibly do a show on back pain? And what I decided was to do it on primarily the non-operative approaches to low back pain, right? So with that, and some of it was prompted by a recent article. So I'll talk a little bit about that. This was a study done in Australia and published in The Lancet, where they looked at 701 adults over 3 years. And they divided everybody into two groups. So there was a treated group, the walking group, right? And basically, these people were in a walking program, and they had six educational sessions on back pain prevention. The other group had no interventions whatsoever, just went along with their daily lives. What they found out was that the walking group was pain-free for twice as long as the control group. So, interesting that you could walk it off. So with that, I decided to look at this in a little more detail and get a guest. So my guest today is going to be Dr. Scott Malozzi, and he's going to be joining us in the second, third, and fourth sections of today's show because we have so many questions for him. As always, I'm going to be taking questions from the audience, and you could reach me at info@alessimd.com. Dr. Malozzi is an assistant professor of orthopedic surgery, specializing in spine surgery at the University of Connecticut. So he's been on our show in the past, I think it was last year, but we wanted to get him back on to really ask about some of the non-operative approaches to back pain. What are some of the things that are mistaken, right? So I bump into people all the time and say they have sciatica, but really, is it involving the sciatic nerve, or is it somewhat confusing because people have hip pain or other types of pain that are often confused with what we consider nerve pain coming from your back? So we're going to be asking him a lot about that. And I guess I have some questions for him regarding what makes him decide whether someone needs surgery or not. So I'm really looking forward to our chat with Dr. Malozzi. This day in medicine, June 29th, 1861, William J. Mayo was born. Now, obviously, Dr. Mayo is one of the founders of the Mayo Clinic. But the story really begins with his father, William W. Mayo. And I don't know if folks are familiar with this story, but it's an interesting story on how the Mayo Clinic got started. His father was in England. His father was a chemist in England and became a pharmacist here in the United States when he emigrated here in 1846. He then went to medical school, graduated from medical school, and ended up in Rochester, Minnesota. And he started a solo practice. Very interesting. He just started a simple general practice in Rochester, Minnesota. But the event that probably started the Mayo Clinic was August 21st, 1883, when a tornado struck Rochester, Minnesota. And many people were seriously wounded, and they didn't have a hospital. So he was treating them in a library. And basically, a lot of the people needed more care than could be provided simply by relatives and friends, because that's the way things were done back then. So what he did was he went to a local convent and recruited the Sisters of St. Francis, who had a convent in Rochester, Minnesota, and he recruited them to serve as nurses. And basically at around that time was when his oldest son, William, who was born this day, had just completed medical school, and his younger son was in his final year of medical school. So they came and assisted his father treating these tornado victims. The Mother Superior of the convent, which was Mother Alfred Mose, she was convinced that they needed a hospital in Rochester. So it was Mother Alfred Mose and the Sisters of St. Francis that started St. Mary's Hospital. And they appointed the Mayo family as being the doctors and surgeons for that hospital. They only had 12 beds at the time, and the Sisters of St. Francis served as the staff. And it's interesting because this is back in 1883. St. Mary's Hospital is still in existence. It is now part of the Mayo healthcare system and part of the Mayo Clinic. So it has really evolved, but it was the sisters that went out and raised all the money and actually built the Mayo Clinic Hospital and what became the Mayo Clinic. So the Mayo Clinic has now part of, or St. Mary's is part of the Mayo Clinic. And in fact, the sisters, I believe someone told me from the Mayo Clinic, that the Sisters of St. Francis still have several seats on the board of directors. And that was part of the arrangement and the long-term arrangement. So it's a very interesting story how the Mayo brothers and their father came together with the sisters. You know, there are so many stories about nuns that are just negative, okay? And people don't understand that it was these religious orders that really brought education and health care to the masses in this country. And it, not just Catholic sisters, but other religious organizations that really brought care, whether it be education or health care, to people. And I think we often forget that and need to look at that back in history. So it was the foresight of Mother Alfred Mose, and she is still revered in Rochester, Minnesota, for starting what is one of the premier medical centers in the world. One other story I wanted to talk about, it came to light this week. You know, we talk a lot about there are new drugs for Alzheimer's disease. And these new drugs that we've talked about on the show before, they're basically monoclonal antibodies. And what they do is they attack this beta amyloid. Beta amyloid gets deposited in the brain, and it is an indicator of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And we now have ways on PET scanning to see this beta amyloid and how it exists and where it is. So a lot of times we're using these drugs now in people who have Alzheimer's disease with the hope that we could arrest the progression of it and possibly improve their status. Well, the studies being done now are quite interesting because what they're looking at are people who have a family history of Alzheimer's disease, scanning their brains and looking to see if they have an excessive amount of beta amyloid. Now, understand, these people are cognitively normal. So on a mini mental status exam, a normal rating could be anywhere from 25 to 30, 30 being a perfect score. So they are looking at a group of people. I think there were 70 people in the first study, and they looked at 70 people who have a history of Alzheimer's disease, had a scan. It looked like they had an excessive amount of beta amyloid, despite the fact that they were cognitively normal, and treated them with these drugs and reduced the amount of beta amyloid. So the question becomes, can we treat Alzheimer's disease early on with these new drugs? And I think that's the idea of these medications, is not to wait, but to try and be somewhat proactive in people who are prone to have Alzheimer's disease. Now, a lot still has to be done on this. These are preliminary studies. They're small studies. But nevertheless, it's going to be very interesting. And the obstacle is going to be these drugs are not inexpensive. These are very expensive medications, and they involve a series of intravenous treatments. But nevertheless, if you can avoid a future of Alzheimer's disease, it would be extremely worthwhile. And I think that as a country, we need to be there, because Alzheimer's disease is going to increase as we get older. With that, we're going to take a short break. If you need to reach out to me, you need to get me at info@alessimd.com. And we're going to be back after a short break with my guest, Dr. Scott Malozzi. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Welcome back to Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce my guest today, Dr. Scott Malozzi. Dr. Malozzi is an assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at the University of Connecticut. He specializes in spine surgery at the Brain and Spine Institute at the University of Connecticut. Hey, Scott, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tony. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk. Let's get right back into it here. Can you frame the issue here that we're dealing with in terms of low back pain? How big a problem is it in the United States and worldwide?
Sure. Low back pain, if you look at certain studies, it'll tell you that pretty much about 80% of Americans as an adult will have a significant episode of low back pain at some point in their life that requires them to take time off from work or out of activities. I would argue that number is probably 100% in terms of who's had low back pain, but in terms of, you know, to the point where it becomes debilitating enough that you have to miss out on events and work and productive things in your life, it's pretty common. Luckily, spine surgery itself is not, you know, what everybody needs for that, but the back pain issue itself is very common. So,
let's talk in general. The Brain and Spine Institute. I should back up a little bit. Can you tell our listeners what the Brain and Spine Institute is at the University of Connecticut?
Sure. So the Brain and Spine Institute is, you know, a collaborative group of subspecialists that came together actually several years ago was when the kind of concept of this Brain and Spine Institute was arisen. And then just about 2 months ago, we actually moved into our new building, which houses the institute. But what it really is a group of spine and neurology and brain subspecialists who all do similar but also very different things to treat patients, whether it's from non-operative care to operative care and everything really in between. So specifically at UConn, what we have is a group of orthopedic spine specialists like myself, and that includes spine surgeons, and then we have a whole team of nurse practitioners and physician's assistants as well who are part of our team. We have neurosurgery, both spine neurosurgery as well as cranial or brain neurosurgery. And then we also have a neurology team over at the Institute doing, you know, nerve disorders, seizure disorder, Parkinson's disease, all multiple sclerosis, things like that, as well as a team of spine physiatrists who are non-operative but interventional physicians and specialists who treat, you know, one of the more common things they do is cortisone injections in the back called epidural injection. So the whole thought is the patient has a issue with whether it's back pain or sciatica or a brain disorder or a neurologic disorder, and they can come to one place in order to be evaluated for it, to be diagnosed with it, and eventually treated for it from start to finish.
When you do surgery, is it at the center or is it at the university?
So So our spine surgeries are done at the university. So the center itself, the new building is on Munson Road in Farmington. So it's actually right around the corner from the main campus of UConn Health in Farmington. So the main hospital, which is where our operating room is around the corner, and that's where we do our spine surgeries.
When we talk about, Scott, the non-operative approaches to low back pain, what does that include? You already mentioned something about epidural injections, but what else does it imply when you're seeing a patient and you determine that they don't need surgical intervention? What kind of non-operative interventions come to mind?
Yeah, so for back and spine issues, you know, certainly the vast majority of patients that I see as a surgeon, but, you know, our office, anybody in my office sees, don't need surgery. And they may have an MRI, or they may have something that could potentially be surgical, but the majority were able to treat successfully non-operatively. So unless there's something potentially dangerous or concerning that it can progress to neurologic dysfunction quickly, then we'll always start out with some non-operative management. One of the more common things, and most people have experienced at some point in their life, whether it is physical therapy. Physical therapy is used in a lot of different ways for spine issues. We often will have patients try a course of physical therapy, even if it's for 6 or 8 weeks, a couple times a week, in order to try to improve their pain from whatever's going on. Even if that's not the only thing that helps, or if that's not the ultimate cure to their pain, then it is often a component of successful treatment regardless. So usually we'll start with that. And physical therapy, other kind of non-operative management options that we have available to us, certainly a lot of people have tried chiropractors or osteopaths and what we call like craniosacral therapy. And those are all kind of versions similar to, you know, the physical therapy. We're trying to, whether it's strengthen or alleviate pain through, you know, physical activity and physical maneuvers. The role of medications in treating back issues and spine issues is there is one for it, certainly. We usually will rely early on in the process on medications such as a short course of steroid by mouth, so like a prednisone for a week or so, which often if you have very acute sudden back pain or nerve pain, we'll start with that. Anti-inflammatories, you know, both over-the-counter such as Advil and Tylenol, and then more prescription versions of that.
Scott, we're going to take a short break. I got to take a short break, they're telling me now, so we can get some ads in. And then I want to get back to the use of medication for low back pain and go over that with you. I'm chatting with Dr. Scott Malozzi. If you have questions for Dr. Malozzi, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be joined with my guest today, Dr. Scott Malozzi. We're talking about non-operative approaches to low back pain. If you wish to reach Dr. Malozzi to make an appointment to have your back evaluated or any other spinal problems, he can be reached at 860-679-4719. Scott, before the break, I wanted to get back to what you were saying. Now, in terms of medication, you talked about oral steroids and non-steroidal medications. How effective is that, just taking two Advil or Aleve that people tend to do? Is it very effective?
It certainly can be effective, and it depends on, I would say, the underlying issue and how long it's been going on for. Certainly, patients who have, you know, sudden onset of low back pain, the vast majority of the time it's muscular or an injury that happened or overuse. And there's a large component of inflammation that occurs with these injuries, and that comes on, you know, relatively suddenly. And the reason why these medications work is they target that inflammation and try to stop the, you know, what we would consider the inflammatory cascade, and try to break that cycle. So patients who, you know, or even just friends or family members who ask me about back pain that they've been having for a couple of weeks, if there's no neurologic red flags or symptoms, I'll often say, hey, take, you know, even if you're feeling okay at parts of the day, for a week, take, you know, over-the-counter Advil or ibuprofen twice a day, regardless, just to try to cut into that cycle of inflammation and try to break it. So they, for many things, they are helpful. Steroids, the oral steroids that we use are best for treating sudden onset of nerve pain. So patients who will have, you know, back or neck pain with, you know, sudden kind of like electrical pain that goes into the arm or the leg, consistent with like a pinched nerve, that's where the oral steroid temporarily really can be quite helpful, at least at abating the severity of the pain. It may not always be the underlying final treatment for it, but sometimes it just breaks it up enough that it doesn't return. So there's certainly a big component that can be treated with over-the-counter medications and anti-inflammatories, but certainly they don't work for everything, and they're not always the final answer for the pain.
At the outset of our program, I mentioned the study that was done in Australia where they had people walk versus those who did not, and they gave them some education and found that works. I guess that brings up the issue, does some light exercise, despite having back pain, help break through it?
It does. Now, certainly, patients will often ask me whether they're feeling good or bad, depending on pain. You know, is it okay to do this and this and this? My kind of around the board answer is that I'd much rather be active than inactive. Now, light activity in the setting of, you know, newer onset back issues and back pain has actually been proven in some studies over the years to improve outcomes and improve patients' symptoms quicker. So if you have, for instance, a disc herniation that happens suddenly and you have back pain and you may or may not have pain that radiates down the leg as well, those patients, you know, looking at lots of these studies that have tracked those patients, they tend to do much better if they have a very brief period of rest, you know, a couple of days up to a week max, and then start either in physical therapy or walking or light activities. And it certainly avoids the possibility of having deconditioning from inactivity, where your muscles very quickly can lose some of their strength and their function, and that can make it very difficult to get out of that cycle. So certainly activity, I think lighter activities in the beginning is recommended. Even in good times when you're not having a lot of back pain or issues, especially if you do have a history of them recurring, maintaining a level of activity such as walking, such as, you know, swimming or biking are all really good things. I usually will recommend trying to focus a little more on lower impact activities. So you had the choice between riding a bike or an elliptical machine or swimming versus jogging on a treadmill. I think it's a good idea to certainly include some lower impact activities as opposed to the kind of constant pounding on pavement and things like that. Granted, a lot of people really enjoy running and jogging and things like that. So I don't try to talk people out of doing that. I think it's a great thing to do both physically and mentally. But if you do like to run, you know, 5-6 days a week, maybe try to incorporate a little bit of lower impact stuff one or two times a week to try to offset some of that impact exercise.
So. Scott, one of the things that comes up, and we have a question in this regard from Will, are things other than the spine causing back pain. So, you know, people who may think they have sciatica as a general term, you know, actually have something else. Can we talk about some of those alternatives? And Will brings up a point of gastrointestinal problems and particularly gas and digestive issues that ended up being a cause of his low back pain. So can you talk about some of those things that fool us to some degree and are not necessarily related to the low back?
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely, you know, it's definitely important to try to be as accurate as you can with what's actually causing, you know, your back pain. You and Will are totally right there. So for back pain, you know, certainly I think, you know, the most common cause of back pain is not a disc herniation necessarily or spinal stenosis. It's muscular pain. So you have a lot of muscles in your low back. You have muscles on your side and your flank area, and those can all be contributing to the back pain and the issues that occur. Gastrointestinal issues such as indigestion, gallbladder disease, and all those things can also cause, you know, everybody thinks predominantly you'd have abdominal pain, but the way the nerves in the body work, they can refer pain elsewhere. So certainly back pain can be associated with gastrointestinal issues. Another kind of source of pain that needs to be investigated and made sure that it's not coming from is kidney stones. Can also have other, you know, referred pain from in your abdominal cavity, different organs like pancreatitis or things of that sort. And then you mentioned sciatica. So sciatica is kind of this grab bag term, almost like, you know, all Kleenex or tissues, but, you know, we call everything by the Kleenex name brand. You know, not all sciatica is necessarily the same, but sciatica, the whole kind of concept is pain originating from the back that radiates down the leg. So nerve pain down the leg, it can be from a pinched nerve, from a disc herniation, from arthritis, from spinal stenosis. But then you can also get things such as SI joint pain, which your sacroiliac joint is a joint, but it doesn't move that much even in a normal person. But that is off to the side in your low back, kind of just above your buttock. And that can generate low back pain that's typically off to the right or the left. And once in a while can actually mimic sciatica a bit and cause some pain that will come down towards the buttock area and the back of the thigh. And other things, so I often will see patients and they have pain that is off to the side of their leg. Maybe they do have back pain, but, you know, hip pain on the side of the hip or down the thigh. So things like IT band syndrome, which is a tendon that runs all the way from the top part of your pelvis down towards the side of your knee, can get tight, and that can cause pain that can mimic sciatica. Bursitis is a pretty common thing we see in patients. And that's, you know, there's different areas you can get bursitis, your shoulder or your hip or other areas, but a common one's off to the side of the hip, and a hip bursitis can mimic and kind of be confused with sciatica at times. So underlying causes of the pain, you know, are very important in my opinion. I think, and I would imagine in everybody's opinion, to figure out what the cause is and treat that most accurately, as opposed to say, you know, if you have a MRI that shows something, but if it doesn't match up with what you would expect to see symptom wise, then you start to have to question yourself as to whether or not you're treating the right thing.
Scott, I want to get back to SI joint pain. You know, I've encountered that several times in patients. I've sent them for injections for pain management. Do injections typically help, injections to the SI joint? Do they generally get good relief with that?
They do tend to help, as long as that's, you know, like I said, as long as that's the correct diagnosis. So the SI joint pain, I would say, you know, I see a lot of people who have been diagnosed with it, you know, whether it's another physician or a physical therapist, or they just did it online and figured out that's, you know, felt that that's what they have. And it's not always the case. So, you know, but if it is originating from the SI joint, the mainstay of treatment really is physical therapy for that. There's kind of a dedicated protocol that physical therapists will use to treat SI joint pain. It may not, like I said, it may not always be the underlying, you know, answer to all the pain. And sometimes we do need to supplement it with an injection. And if an injection is helpful, but it's temporary, you can repeat it. If injections and physical therapy are helping, but pain continues to recur, there is a potential role for surgical intervention in SI joint pain. Typically, it's a fusion across that joint. My strong belief is that that procedure is overused at this point, but I do think there is actually a role for it. And if patients fail to get sustained relief with all these other treatments, such as therapy and injections, then that's where I think surgery does make sense.
I have another question from Bob. Do back braces work? What do you think?
Yeah, so back braces are very common. They're easy to obtain, and they have a limited but a real role. So I get asked this question a lot, and I we use rigid or harder, you know, plastic type back braces typically for traumatic injuries that require stabilization. So say you have a fracture to your spine, and it may not be something that requires surgery, or maybe it's borderline, and then we may recommend a rigid brace, especially when you're up and out of bed, to try to provide some additional stability so that can heal. Back braces that are rigid and hard for sciatica, for chronic low back pain, there's some evidence that they actually may do more harm than good, because they kind of limit the ability of your body to use the muscle that you already have, and they take some of the work away from the muscles, and then you actually can lose that musculature, and it can be this downward cycle. So I do recommend, when patients, you know, are looking for something like a back brace, which may be very helpful for activity, for, you know, when the pain is really bad, I recommend a soft brace. So more of a stretchy type brace that almost acts as like an ACE bandage for your back, right? It provides a little bit of extra support, but doesn't totally stop your muscles and your core from doing their job. So I think softer back braces can be very helpful. And I recommend, you know, when you are resting or, you know, not up and about, that if you are using it to remove it at that point.
Scott, that brings to mind some of these other home devices that we hear about, like these massage devices. A lot of people have started to use the Theragun or something of that nature, where it kind of pounds a little bit, heat, ice, things like that, some basic things. Do they work?
They certainly work for some people, and I think they have a role for sure. So the nice thing about ice and heat, as well as, you know, topical patches that are over the counter, lidocaine patches or Bengay or topical solutions like that, or even a home massage unit like a Theragun, the risk of them is pretty minimal, right? So I think, you know, sure, the they can be expensive, some of the things, and there's a big business out there that, with a lot of money involved for these things. But I recommend, if you are going to try some of those things, and maybe invest, you know, in a cheaper one, or invest in one thing at a time and see if it really helps for you. If you do go to like a physical therapist first, oftentimes they will have some of these adjunct treatments like the massage gun, things like that, and you try it out with them first. And if you finish that, you know, those several visits of physical therapy, and you say, hey, you know what, that's been really helpful for me, talk to your therapist, or talk to, you know, your physician or people who have treated you for it, and say, is this, you know, one I is there an available one on the market that you would recommend? So I think they play a role for sure. I know there's a lot of potential to spend a lot of money and not really get very far there. But I do recommend them to patients, especially when they've been dealing with this for a long time.
How about manipulative therapy? So when we hear about traction, chiropractic manipulation, osteopathic manipulation, when it comes to the low back, is it helpful?
It can certainly be helpful, and it's not helpful for everybody. But you know, as long as it's done safely and in a controlled manner, I do think, especially for patients, you know, who have chronic back pain, chronic issues that maybe flare up all the time, every few months, and they take time out of work or activities as a result. Sometimes these procedures and these manipulative therapies can really help them get back on track. That being said, they certainly don't work for everybody. I think in a patient, especially who may not, you know, may have been dealing with pain for quite some time and get to the point where, you know, they everything they've done is not really working, and they come to see someone like me, and maybe we get an MRI and it doesn't look too bad, and I can't, you know, I don't have a surgical, surgical procedure to offer them necessarily. I think things like that, more like kind of maintenance of your back and trying to deal with these flare-ups, those can be very helpful. So traction units, again, home traction units, if done safely, can be very helpful for people with chronic back or neck pain. They tend to be a little more effective for neck pain, but there's also potential risk there with doing too much. So again, I recommend if you're going to do something like a home traction unit, maybe we start out with trying it out in a physical therapist's office or with a chiropractor or someone or an OMT who does these procedures, and they work with you. And if you find that it's helpful, they'd be able to recommend one for at home that would be safe.
What about stem cells? One of my pet peeves when it comes to shelling out cash. But, you know, everybody's out there saying, oh, they could do stem cells and stem cell this and stem cell that. Have you found any advantage to stem cell injections for low back pain?
There's not any reliable stem cell procedure available at this time that I'm aware of for back issues. There is a lot of research and money being invested to try to find, reliable, appropriate stem cell treatment for back pain, for healing disc herniations and disc disease, for patients who have spinal cord injuries and are, you know, can we reverse or, limit the effects of paralysis. So I think there is a lot of potential out there. And I do honestly fully expect in the next, 20 to 30 years that we make a lot of advancement in that department. But right now, there's nothing really available that is reliable enough and reproducible enough that I would recommend. As you said, Tony, there's a lot of it is not yet approved, to be done with insurance, and it's predominantly a cash based. Out-of-pocket costs. So there's a lot of potential to spend a lot of money, but I don't think the evidence is there yet to support anything specifically. But I do have a lot of hope that in the near future, hopefully, we do have that answer.
Scott, in closing, in the next couple of minutes, can you share with us what are the top things you look for in a patient where you decide this person needs an operation and the non-operative interventions are not working?
Sure. I think the number one thing is making sure that I am confident in that I have the right diagnosis. So I tell patients a lot how, despite being, a spine surgeon, we're much better at treating and identifying nerve pain that arises from the spine. So sciatica and leg pain, as opposed to just low back pain. Certainly we can get that better, and I think we often do, but it's a little more nebulous to determine exactly where your back pain is coming from. While with nerve pain. We have, you know, different disc levels, different nerves at different levels of the spine are expected based on anatomy to cause pain and numbness and symptoms in a very specific area. So I use that, number one, to make sure that I'm trying to treat the appropriate diagnosis. So I want to make sure that what I see on your x-rays, on your MRI, is consistent with what your symptoms are. In addition, you know, we touched briefly on those epidural steroid injections. I think they're a great alternative when things like medications and physical therapy have not been helpful, because it allows you to say, hey, you have this finding at, you know, the L4-5 disc. It seems to match up pretty well with your symptoms. Let's try to target that area with a cortisone shot. And if we do that and you get better and it never comes back, that's the best outcome. But even if you get better temporarily, even for several weeks or a couple of months, and that pain comes back, it's a good diagnostic sign that, hey, I have the right target. And if you go through all these treatment options and we can not, you know, unfortunately aren't able to get you better symptom-wise long-term or permanently, then that's where I think surgery is a reasonable next step, as long as you have an appropriate target. In addition, I like to, you know, obviously I prefer a patient who is motivated to get better and wants to get back to activities and work and just getting back, you know, reasons to get better. And luckily the majority of people do, certainly. Having an appropriate motivation to get better, to, you know, realize that spine surgery, all surgery, but spine surgery in particular, can be a pretty extensive recovery, depending on, you know, what you need done. So you got to be invested enough to understand that, reasonable enough to understand there's going to be a recovery period and that you need to participate in your own recovery. And that can involve physical therapy, doing home exercises with physical therapy on a daily basis going forward, and really doing the work on the patient's part. But, you know, in addition to the work that we do to help you out, to get you through that recovery and get you as good as you can be.
Scott, thank you. Thank you very much for sharing all this information for many people with low back pain. If you're interested in getting in touch with Dr. Malozzi and setting up an appointment, you could do that by calling 860-679-4719. Scott, thanks again for your time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds, as always. If you missed any part of today's program, just download it on the Healthy Rounds podcast, which you can get at Odyssey.com. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.